welcome to this week's episode of Data Protection Made Easy. With me, the organiser, Miles Dakers, and I'm joined for the purpose of this intro by David Holmes and Carrie James. We're sadly missing Oliver this week, but he was live and joining us on the session. It was a good session today, wasn't it? Wasn't it, David?
It certainly was, yeah. I got quite a lot from it, actually. There's a lot of bits and pieces going around, because subject access requests can be quite complicated. And, you know, I like to try and come up with titles and things for these kind of things. And I was struggling today because we didn't normally kind of cover some of the news to the same level. So my title that I've come up off the top of my head is SARS with reasonable adjustments. So I don't know if...
Not quite as catchy as you won last week, was it? I think last week's was a cookie by any other name is still a cookie, wasn't it? That was, yeah.
For sure.
And how about you, Carrie? How did you find it?
Yeah, I mean, SARS are one of my favourite things. I always find them really interesting. I think I'm quite interested in sort of like when you actually see the files and seeing like it's like a little window looking into somebody else's life. And so we sort of did talk about that and like that also that some of these things can actually be quite distressing to read for staff and having support in place for staff and sort of how you can make it easier to get those SARS done, you know, talking about chronology and if you get in contact with the data subject, how you can help them and also what actually constitutes personal data anyway. You know, like when you search somebody's name in an email and you return a million email results, but actually most of them aren't even about that person, you know.
Definitely. I think there was some really exciting, interesting topics that were covered, and a lot of topics that we wouldn't ordinarily cover in our SAR discussion because we don't normally get that far down, and don't normally get to discuss as much as that. But because we've hosted part two this time, it's given us a lot more time to discuss those specifics
and potential part three. So do keep an eye out for that within the.
There's definitely enough to speak about, isn't there? So, we have plenty of time up in the calendar to fill in for some new events. So, if you did join us live, you will know that we did ask our listeners if they do have any topics or anything they would like to discuss in the near future. Then you can reach out to one of the team. We are shaping up our events for the rest of Q1. So feel free to get in touch with any one of the team. But I think that about recaps it, David. Do you think we should hop into the session now?
I think so. And then I've just decided if we're not going to go with SARS with reasonable adjustments, because although I'm from Yorkshire, I'm based in Essex, the best I've got is the only way is SARS.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Oh, I think definitely go into the session now.
And on that bombshell, yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for your intros. Thank you for being such brilliant hosts as well in the session. I'm sure everyone who's listening will experience that shortly. So, yeah, without further ado, I'll leave you in the capable hands of Carrie James, David Holmes and Oliver Rea.
Do that topic that Miles mentioned that Carrie's written about, obviously subject access requests, so let's get stuck in. As I said before, that a couple bits in the news because there's always plenty to talk about. Once again this week, Mark has been in touch with me to give me the lowdown on a news story. I have to say, Mark, I had spotted this one this week, I'm afraid, but thanks for sending it in anyway, which is that for all those that are big crisp fans might be in trouble because we're due some crisp shortages over the coming months due to a ransomware attack on KP Snacks, the ones behind McCoy's, Hula Hoops, etc. Just a bit of fun. But, you know, again, it sort of demonstrates that cyber attacks can have sort of real world impact, particularly for those of us who are a fan of a bag of McCoy's. Do you see this, Dave and Carrie?
I hadn't seen this, so as soon as I saw it in our notes, I was clicking straight on the article to be like, is this my favourite crisps or not? And it's not my favourite crisps. So I personally will not be absolutely devastated by this news. But it's quite interesting how they just go after like a crisp company. I don't know whether it's just me. I would never have thought of those being attacked by ransomware things. I always think of big things like the NHS and government organisations. But crisp company are going to have a lot of money. Which is if that would, yes, that's what they're after.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm inclined to ask you what your favourite crisp is now because I'm curious since you've announced it with that vigour. Go on, fill us in.
You know the Walker's Poppadoms with the lime and coriander? They're my current favourites.
Yeah, really good choice. Good choice. Good choice. I'll give you that. Dave, do you want to weigh in on this? Normally it's you bringing unrelated topics to the conversation.
Yeah, so
I feel
no,
like you must have something to contribute to this.
I was actually going to say the ransomware attack on crisp companies must have left them quavering in the boots, with a slight pun towards quavers there. I know it's awfully bad. But I think it highlights that the ransomware and people that are behind it will actually, I get Carrie's point, there'll be where's the money, let's go after the money argument with some big national, multinational organisations, but they will look to where the money is in organisations that might not be set up, or should be set up potentially, maybe not have the focus on information security in the same ways as other organisations might. They might be deemed kind of looking at organisations now that might potentially have the ability to be infiltrated because of taking the eye off the ball from an InfoSec point, and therefore everybody's fair game ultimately.
For sure. Michael's saying that hopefully their servers are not frazzled, so you've got some competition, Dave, on the bad on this front, I'm afraid. But I tell you what, I mean, because the thing is, we joke and we talk about crisps, etc., but really also in the news this morning is that some major oil storage and transport companies across Europe have been hit with ransomware, and that is obviously substantially more concerning. I don't know, apparently it's not coordinated, but I don't know if either of you saw this.
I'd seen something on it. I don't know if you'd seen anything, Carrie. I had seen something on it. Again, I'm not sure if it's coordinated or not, but I had seen that they'd gone after the oil and those kind of supplies. So, like I say, it comes back to being everybody's fair game to criminals, aren't they? So you've got to be on top of your InfoSec. You've got to understand where your weaknesses are and address them. Have regular reviews and have a kind of a continuous cycle for review and improvement. Across the board, so there's more and more of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure. Adrian's mentioning something that I think we covered a couple of weeks ago, which is Gloucester City Council also, and I believe their systems have been down since like end of November, start of December, something like that. So that's been ongoing for a long time. It's affecting like a lot of council services, and that's significantly less light-hearted. But yeah, I mean, as you say, it demonstrates the importance of continuously sort of benchmarking, testing, improving, I guess. Absolutely crucial. There's plenty of other bits and pieces in the news, although I don't know if there's any more sort of ransomware related or cyber attack related news items that either of you two wanted to cover.
I haven't got anything this week, I'm afraid. I think I peaked with the Ministry of Justice thing 2 weeks ago.
This is where the struggle is for preparing for these, Carrie. So you've got to keep coming up with the news items.
I mean, would I be eating crisps? I'm not sure.
No, maybe not. Maybe not. I'll tell you what I did see, which I thought was interesting this week, is that, and again, this is potentially slightly tangential, but stick with me for a second, which is that the stock market value of Meta as a company, so obviously the Facebook parent group that's rebranded, has taken an incredible hit. I mean, they reckon that in terms of value, it's lost £170 billion worth of value on the stock exchange. Now, those numbers are, you know, not necessarily directly relatable, but I think the reason that it's interesting is I've seen a lot of commentary in relation to this recently, whereby I think if we remember that Facebook as a company was served with that Federal Trade Commission fine in the US, which they effectively just wrote off, and they were able to protect Mr. Zuckerberg in particular with how it was structured. When you look at this loss of value for various reasons, including, you know, competition, but also some of the enforcement action which is starting to affect them in terms of, for instance, the Apple transparency tracker framework, that's really what is hitting them hard now. Investors are starting to worry, value starting to slump, and you know, personal wealth is taking a hit in relation to people like Mr. Zuckerberg. And I think this again is an example. This is the reason I raise it, of fines and enforcement action in that sense isn't always necessarily what is going to drive change in compliance. I just thought it was interesting. I mean, I know it's something we've spoken about a lot in terms of where you know, pressures can come from in that sense. And I thought this was another example, albeit an extreme example of it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think something that kind of nicely links it. I don't know if you caught it. Was I saw it in the Guardian earlier this week, and it was about what does your smart TV know about you, and how much data is your smart TV harvesting in that sense. And there was an article talking about the fact that it's smart TVs are connected obviously to the internet, and they're now becoming kind of two ways now, not just a kind of a broadcasting that you sit and absorb. It's actually potentially watching you, maybe not through your cameras, but watching your viewing habits, watching what you look like, having automatic content recognition operating in the background. So all this mass data harvesting and bits and pieces operating in the background, again through not necessarily saying cookies is sent, but a similar type of track technology there that you're mentioning, especially where you get potentially cross-device tracking, whether it's your phone, whether it's your smart TV, your tablet, that kind of thing. So there was a nice article about that in the Guardian. I don't know if anybody caught that, or if you'd like me to post a link to it, if I can.
No, I missed that, I'm afraid. But if you've got the link, I'd be curious to see it if you want to pop it in the chat. But yeah, I think this is kind of the crux of it, really, which is we talk about the impacts of this sort of thing. And just to come back to sort of the earlier point we were saying about the impact on people of you know, cyber attacks or whatever it might be. Lucinda's saying in the chat that Premier Property had a big ransomware attack towards the back end of last year, which resulted in their house sale falling through, which I'm very sorry to hear. But that's the thing, isn't it? We talk a lot of time in terms of these sort of grand conceptual issues. You know, we talk about fines, we talk about, you know, damage to reputation, etc. But it's something we try and drive a lot, isn't it, Dave and Carrie, that ultimately, when we're talking about privacy, personal data, etc., ultimately, these are real people and it's their information and the activities their information is involved in, which are affected down the line, isn't it?
For sure. I spend a lot of time with delivering training and things, and that tries to highlight the fact that when we're talking about personal data, when we're talking about information security, what we're actually talking about is people and people's lives. It's a very human element to the roles that we do as debt protection officers, the roles that we do in looking after or making sure that organisations are compliant with debt protection rules and regulations and things, because it's got a very, very human element to it. Inappropriate use, misuse, negligent measures towards protecting individuals' data has got the opportunity to have a real impact on people's lives, and it's trying to be mindful of that in all that we do. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, there's just one last bit I wanted to raise in the news item before we move on, which is, and really it's more of a formality than anything else, because to be honest, I'm going to be completely frank, I'm not massively interested in this, which is another pecker fine in the UK, this time for an organisation, Home2Sense, fined £200,000 for aggressive marketing practices in violation of pecker. Our colleague Matthew did the maths on it. He reckons it works out about 30p a call in terms of the fine. Honestly, I'm only really mentioning it as a formality because I don't know about everyone else, and maybe I'm just being a bit flippant, but there's just nothing to say about these fines. They're not particularly, it's not that they're not important, but you know, it's hardly groundbreaking at this point. It's the same thing every other week, isn't it, really? Sort of fines for pecker breaches, which aren't particularly crippling, and yeah, I'm not sure how much more there is to say, really. I don't know if either of you had anything you want to contribute to that, or maybe change the tone slightly. Because
I'm not trying to jump in. If you have anything to say, Carry, then please do jump in, or anybody else mind in that sense. But again, I think it's coincidental. It kind of segues quite nicely into what I'd seen in the news. Well, it kind of published this week. John Edwards, the new information commissioner, the ICO, the new information commissioner, had a little podcast or a little video on the ICO's website asking for people's opinions. I don't know if you've come across the fact that the ICO are now in listening mode. There's methods on how to do that through the ICO's website to give them feedback, but they are interested in listening to what's worked, what's not working, some of the benefits, some of the struggles that people are having with death protection laws and bits and pieces. So they're really in a listening mood in that sense. So it's anybody, as with yourself, Ollie, if you're getting frustrated that the focus seems only to be on Pekka, might be a relevant thing just to direct back to the ICU.
Yeah, 100%. I think we mentioned it last week, or the week before, I forget, whenever it first came out. But yeah, sort of stop us moaning and instead actually provide some constructive criticism and actually try and inform things going forwards. Just before we move on, because I'm aware we are meant to be talking about SARS, and I want to get to that because there's still loads that we didn't cover last time around. I'm curious about a story that Emma's put in the chat about a data breach compensation case that's been thrown out of the High Court, which involved a faulty TV that was sold on by Currys and hadn't had the data wiped from it. I'll be honest, I haven't seen this, so I don't know anything about it. Emma, if you want to come on, please do.
I had read something loosely on that, that there's a problem with the TV, and again, smart TVs. And it was linked, like a Netflix account or something like that, that was accessible through the smart TV. And they returned the TV. They said, I think Currys said, don't delete anything, just return the TV to us and we'll have a look. They went back, had a look at the TV, thought it was all right, then resold the TV onto somebody else and likewise hadn't wiped it. So then somebody accessed the TV, realised that there was an open account and then started watching videos or buying something through the open account that was on the TV. That's loosely. Emma, please do come in if there's a lot more detail on that. But that was my kind of quick scant look at it when I came across it earlier, a couple of days ago.
I think someone accessed their Amazon Prime account and bought something for £3.60 or something. So that was what alerted the data subject to the fact that their information had been sort of passed on to someone else. But yeah, I think you've covered most of the details. Just thought it was interesting with what you were saying about the data on TVs and things.
Smart TVs, yeah.
What's kind of on there?
You could use the same analogy for anybody who passes on any or resells on any used tablets, mobile phones, that kind of thing. And whether you wipe it and you understand how to wipe it before you send it on, or whether it's sold on as it is. In that sense, so there's a link there to portable devices that we may be carrying ourselves.
For sure, it's interesting because most retailers will take back used electrical goods in that sense. At least, you know, devices like tablets, phones, etc. Sort of, well, at least the ones I've dealt with tend to insist that you factory reset it before they'll take it and make sure that it's wiped. But you know, I don't know where the responsibility for that lies. It's interesting because if you've ever been to, it's happened to me before, where you check into an Airbnb and there's a smart TV and you knock it on an evening and, you know, it's signed into a bunch of accounts of people who've stayed in that place before. And you sort of go, this is not very sensible, is it? To sort of look into something and then just forget and leave it. But I suppose it's easily done, isn't it? You know, it's interesting to see how these things develop. I noticed the other week that I had to manually turn off cookies on my smart TV at home, which isn't a great look. But we're going to end up talking about cookies again. We do this every week, and for once, we're actually not supposed to be talking about cookies. So I suggest that we move on and actually talk about subject access requests, if everyone's happy with that.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, on that note, let's get stuck in. So we spoke a lot about SARS last week, and there were some interesting bits in there, in particular, again, just to drive the blog that Carrie's written about third-party sort of rights portals, which is a particularly interesting one. We spoke a fair bit about that last week. So if you missed that, I'd urge you to go back and listen on Spotify, Apple Music, etc., because that's an interesting conversation. But there's a few more bits we can pick up this week. We also mentioned, Dave, as I say, your point about KPIs. I think I did you justice on that, although if you want, you can always bring it back up. But really, we're talking about sort of top tips for handling DSARS, and there's still bits to talk about. One of the ones that I've got down here that I think Carrie had put in my notes is about the content of SARS and potentially quite distressing content, making sure that you've got the right people and support in place. But I don't know, Dave, if you wanted to start us anywhere else since you missed last week's session.
No, I think it's a couple of weeks ago. I think last week was GDPR Radio. I think you're probably talking a couple of weeks ago. So you did the KPIs justice on the week then I wasn't there. We also spoke about the KPI element last week on the GDPR Radio, and not just the benefits of KPIs in the sense of just performance indicators, but what information do they tell you around what you're monitoring and that kind of stuff. So if anybody wants me to go repeat that, they're more than happy to repeat that here, or alternatively jump onto one of the previous versions on the podcast on the website and things and go back and have a listen to it. I'm sure it's up there, and I'm sure Miles will confirm at the end that it'll be available if it is in that sense. I think moving on with what Carrie mentioned is really interesting, because you do get some ordinary run-of-the-mill DSARs that's kind of just neither here nor there. It's maybe tenants and antisocial behaviour complaints. It might be a disgruntled employee. But then you do get some really, really, really sensitive DSARs where individuals have been going through quite a lot, and there's health and social healthcare matters in there, abuse cases and things. And it's really interesting that Carrie raised that, because as you kind of led into that, I have worked in similar situations where individuals and employees working with such families, with such kids, have some form of internal counselling or internal kind of support from senior managers to understand and to guide and to support them accordingly with what can be potentially distressing material. So although it's not a DSAR issue, in that sense, those who are processing the DSAR may come across such distressing material. And how do we deal with those individuals, and how do we address the concerns that they may have or thoughts that they may have moving forward from their exposure to it?
Yeah, 100%. And I don't know if you want to come in on this, Carrie, because obviously you had long experience working in the public sector in particular. So, you know, local authorities, you'd see all sorts. But I know that previously even we've handled DSARs as a third party for clients, for customers. And, you know, even I've worked a couple that have had some potentially very distressing material in there, as Dave says, accounts that are you know, hard to read, quite frankly, at points. So interested to hear more from you on this, Carrie.
Yeah, so this is because I worked specifically with councils, and so I did a lot of children's SARs, like children's services. So a lot of them might have been foster care ones. Some might be where the children are still in the home, but they're receiving social care help. And it's sort of making sure that staff are aware of what they're going into a little bit with some of these. So this sort of brings you back to sort of getting some good scoping on it, you know, making sure that not only are family members identified and stuff like that, but just anything that might come up as potentially upsetting, so staff members, so the people reviewing it are just aware to look out for this kind of thing in the file, and they're not going through like three pages of some sort of like regular notes and then getting hit with something really different and distressing. And just that making sure staff know that, you know, they don't have to power through on reading that if it's upsetting them, that they can take a break, they can speak to somebody, make sure that like organisations have something in place to help people read that. Because I think I did a lot of SARs, and I think over time you do get a little bit desensitised from it. So I think over time you get desensitised so you can sort of handle the more upsetting ones. But if you've got somebody in your team that's maybe quite new to your team, new to the sector, new to like starting out with SARS, you maybe want to be mindful of the things you're giving them, like initially as their first couple of SARS, that it's not something that's going to be upsetting, because whilst they're also sort of learning how to apply the redactions, learning sort of different terminology, acronyms that come up in public sector or whatever your organisation uses, that's like, if it's something particularly distressing, that's also another layer for them to take on quite early on, I think. And I think that's something that you sort of should ensure that like more experienced members of staff handle, just because of the, you know, the nature of the things. Like there's very few SARs I've ever put down and thought, actually, you know what, that's too much. But there was like one or two where I was doing it and I was like, you know what, that's enough SAR for today, close the computer, go out for a walk, because you just need to have a break from it.
No, for sure. I think it's I think it links nicely to a point which Dave was sort of touching on slightly there, which again is a very important one, particularly in the sort of circles that we're talking about. You know, whether it's care or local authorities, children's services, etc., which is also obviously making sure that we have fully understood and applied any applicable serious harm tests, which I know that is a particularly interesting topic, and we can talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But also just being aware that, and generally this isn't, I don't think, too much of an issue, because usually the organisations in question have a good understanding of the people requesting the information and any issues that they may be suffering with. But you know, potentially the data subject themselves will become party to information which might upset them, which may aggravate or exacerbate existing health mental health concerns, anything to do with anxieties, etc. So just making sure that A, we've applied all of the appropriate exemptions where necessary to protect them, but then also, you know, at that disclosure point, if it's a case of bringing them into bringing them on location and actually having someone sit with them and work through it and explain what everything is, I think there's real value in that potentially, because it obviously, you know, it can always be distressing, and we see a lot of instances, particularly in social housing, which we're working quite heavily with, whereby you potentially have vulnerable tenants with complex mental health needs, and the sheer volume of information returned from a SAR can be enough to send them spiraling potentially. Because, you know, obviously if you're a tenant of a housing association and you have need, you know, complex care needs, then potentially there's going to be a lot of data generated about you, and none of it's, you know, nefarious or anything like that. It's just a large volume of information, but that in and of itself can sometimes be enough. We see a lot of it, don't we, Dave? I mean, it's complex, isn't it?
So some of them are really, really complex for sure. And quite, like you say, you might get desensitized to it, but it can still be quite harrowing to read where there's young kids involved, bits and pieces. Yes, you've got to go through and understand what information can be disclosed and why. Is it going to be prejudicial to anything? As you kind of go through that, who's asking for the information. So you've got all your normal kind of bits and pieces to go through in there. You've got the exemptions within the Data Protection Act 18, looking at, the, like you said, the harm tests and so on down there. But it's still the impact on the individual actually reading the material. That it was just interesting, because it was just a thought I had when Carrie started talking about it, is do we actually consider the impact that going through such material might have on the individual actually reviewing the case, applying the redactions and exemptions and making determinations on potentially what's disclosable or not disclosable, and having to review harrowing accounts or review photographic evidence or anything else that might be in there.
Yeah, for sure. If we could just actually talk a little bit about the serious harm test, because there's some conversation about that in the chat. So just so we're all clued up on this. So under, and Dave, I'm relying on you here heavily to correct me where I'm wrong on this front, because I think you understand it better than I do. But under Schedule 3 of the Data Protection Act, there are a number of exemptions relating to specifically, I think, social work data, education data, and health data, which basically say that where the disclosure of that information according to a qualified professional would cause serious harm to the individual, then you can withhold it. But actually, it's not just that, is it? It's if you are a body which is not you know, that of the appropriate professional, and you are holding that type of information, then you have to get the approval of an appropriate professional in the first place to disclose it. It's quite confusing, but I think that's right, is it?
Yeah, and there's also a relevant period, so you've got that kind of relevant period to look at, as in have you had an opinion from the relevant body identified within whichever exemption you're looking at. So if you're looking at the exemption to do with going to be an appropriate health opinion, individual, and that's opinion's got to be within 6 months, hasn't it, something like that, from the date that you're seeking to rely on it. So the opinion's got to be relevant and recent in that sense. You certainly can't rely on an opinion that's potentially outdated. But there's some other qualifiers around it as well, isn't there? There's other bits and pieces around whether the serious harm test has been met in relation to whether the individual knows the document exists and has really been aware of that information and that kind of thing. So it's quite a funny one to kind of step through, but it's certainly one to be certainly to be aware of. And as you're going through with all the different types of serious harm tests and the qualifications to rely on, I've certainly seen people trying to rely on the serious harm test because they felt it would cause serious harm, and it may well do, but then struggled with the concept that it might not be their opinion that's got to determine whether the serious harm test has been engaged or not.
I had a situation recently where I'd be curious to get the opinion of the community on this potentially, which was that. So basically, one of my housing clients came to me and said, we currently use, so for those who aren't in housing, maybe a little bit of background, but it's common practice for social housing providers to use a warning marker or flag system for tenants who are potentially either aggressive or have complex mental health needs or any other issues like that, whereby it would justify potentially a two-person visit to the property for the safety of the operative. And so you would put a warning marker on the system to that effect. Now, my client came to me and said, well, we've had a request to not just start putting warning markers on, but to specify why there is a warning marker. So, for instance, saying that this person needs a two-person visit because of their mental health needs or because of ancestral behaviour or past convictions, etc. And they were saying, well, where would we stand in relation to a SAR? Well, obviously, the default premise is that all of that information would be accessible. But I suppose this is where it starts to become murky. If it's health information and you're logging that against a warning marker, would you need the prior approval of a health professional, sorry, to state that the serious harm test is not met? That's where it starts to get a bit murky. And then there's sort of an argument of saying, well, if you didn't want to disclose the warning markers to the tenants, in theory, you could put health data against them so that you'd have to go through the serious harm test. But then, you know, obviously a health professional might look at it and say there's absolutely no risk, so you have to disclose it. And you're getting into some pretty interesting and very grey territory. I don't know if I've explained that well. It's not particularly fresh in the mind, but yeah, I don't know if any of you have got any thoughts about that, but this is where it starts to get incredibly complex, and it's especially complex when you've got these organisations who are not healthcare providers and do hold quite a lot of health information for various reasons, obviously introducing a number of complexities. Either of you want to try and field that, or shall we move swiftly on without saying anything more about it?
I think the bits I'm going to say on it, and Carol will probably say the same, well, probably also the same, really, is the fact that with any of these exemptions, it's a case-by-case assessment. It's not a blanket assessment. It's not a case of, oh, we've got something about health that we can remove it on serious harm tests without any due consideration. It's a case-by-case. It's like with any of the exemptions and redactions that we can apply, they're a case-by-case approach. And they've got to have that assessment behind. Difficult at times if you're a rather complex case, you're up against the time or you've got volumes of data to work through and bits and pieces. So the management of DSARs and the process and the resources taken to process them can be awfully swept up in everything and kind of appear to disappear quite quickly when you've got such complexities to work through and to understand, especially where they're not applied in a like I said, by on a blanket basis. In that sense.
Yeah, I agree. Like, as you were saying, case by case basis, I was thinking it in my head. It's case by case basis.
Well, it's nice to get a degree of harmony for once on this platform. Okay,
I'll pick up on that harm test bit with you outside of this, because I'd like to just kick it around a little bit more, because I was probably thinking about some other bits to pick up as opposed to necessarily fully listening to, and I do apologise on that, Ollie. But obviously the harm test relates the harm the information could cause to the individual, like the data subject in this sense. isn't it? That's kind of the harm test that we're looking at, and not necessarily to apply it to the fact that the individual may cause harm to people going around because they're violent, potentially, but that's possibly not necessarily linked to the health implications of why they might be of harm to themselves by disclosing a report by a psychologist, for example.
Yeah, no, for sure. Sorry if I didn't explain that properly. That's what I was getting at. Because the idea being that if you found out that your landlord had marked you as a risk to others and therefore needed a two-person visit, that potentially could potentially be quite damaging to you, because you might sort of get a bit potentially paranoid about it and say anything really can, depending on the particular individual situation, as we say, case by case basis, can send them spiraling. Toby makes a good point, which is a lawful basis for holding that special category data, not giving it sufficient thought. I think when we've looked at it, I'm trying to relate it back, because I don't think we even got that far. I just sort of said, look, this is a bit of a minefield, and I don't purely from a minimization point of view, I don't think it's justified.
It'd have to be proportional as well, and you'd expect out of transparency that there's some process behind it. If somebody's having a flag put against the system because potentially violent, then the individual should be aware that actually we're putting this monitoring on your flag because you're violent. We need you to change your behaviour towards our members of staff when they come around to do whatever they need to do with the properties, with the social housing example that you provided. The may with the odd occasion where you've got to put a potential risk flag against an individual and potentially not tell them. But out of transparency, most of them, you'd like to think that there's a process of informing them that it's there as a measure that they're aware of and understand the reason why there is a two-person visit, or why why you've got to have two guys going around and no lone female operative or something in between. And we should be being transparent about that. So we're being transparent to the individual. I'm not quite sure why, other than on the housing management system, why you'd have anything other than the fact that you've got this flag that means two individuals have got to go together. I'm not quite sure what the purpose of having the flag explained further would be when you've got a due process that would govern that, I would have thought. But
and that's kind of the point that I was making, which is that, you know, ultimately, I say from a necessity and a minimization point of view, I don't think it's justified. It's interesting if you try and relate it back to something else, which is that we're getting severely off topic here, so I'm going to bring this to a close now.
The point I was going to try and bring it back to was in relation to SARS, because if you've got a transparent process or a non-transparent process about, doesn't necessarily mean that information would be withheld. That information may well then be disclosed, and then you're in a position of, well, how long has this flag been on against my record for? I didn't know it was there. I didn't know the purpose of it. You put something against my record, being treated me potentially differently because of that flag against my record, and I had no awareness of it, and I wasn't able to change my behaviour as a result. So you've got to be careful about what we're putting against it, against the CRM system, housing management systems, whatever we're using, because it may well be disclosable under a DSA.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. And I had another point to make, but actually that's too good of a segue to pass it up. So we can come back to the warning marker thing at a later date.
On DSARS, I've got a really, really interesting question, and it's more because I've not necessarily fully worked with them to the extent that Carrie has. So I'm kind of aiming it at Carrie slightly, and I do apologise, Carrie, if it catches you off guard and it's not meant to. But it's in relation to if you output a DSAR. Have you ever output a DSAR, being mindful of the Equality Act and needing to make reasonable adjustments for individuals that may need adjustments making to the output file so that they can engage with it in a similar way?
Yeah. There was one person, that I can think of where we did do that. And we just had to make sure that the people who were liaising in the service area with that person noted down all the requirements, and we were able to fulfill it. So we didn't send it over as an electronic file, we printed it off, but there was specific things
font
for printing
sizes.
It off. Yeah.
Okay, like, so font sizes and we, style and that kind of
yeah. Yeah, font size, style, paper colour. We printed it off in that format.
Because it's really interesting, because I've always been aware of it, but I've never actually seen it applied. But if you do fail to make reasonable adjustments under circumstances, you may find yourself subject to the Equality Act. And for failing to make reasonable adjustments for individuals that may need support with because of communication difficulties, whether it's the ability for eyesight to read or audio format if they've lost all eyesight together and so on and so forth. But I've never actually seen it applied in practice. So although I was aware it was there, it was certainly interesting to, it's a point I just wanted to raise really to see if anybody else, and in addition to yourself, Carrie, if anybody's listening that's had to kind of considered the Equalities Act with the DSAR output file, it'd be certainly interesting to listen to the steps you had to take and what was deemed reasonable and how you came about to what measures you took to address that.
I don't think we ever directly said we're going to do this under the Equalities Act or anything like that. I don't know if we really thought of it in that perspective. It was just that this person was known to the council, known that they had specific needs that customer services knew that they had. And so we were just like, okay, well, we'll do it then, because they're entitled to a copy of this information. If this is the way that they can, this is the way that makes it best for them to read and access, then we'll output it that way.
Mm. Interesting. It's certainly interesting, because obviously you have that awareness of the individual and kind of complied with it, but it's certainly an interesting point in order to not look like we're discriminating by the output being in one particular format.
No, it was just the way they requested it, and so we checked that, you know, this is it. And then they were a bit of a frequent requester, and over time they put in another request where actually the requirements were slightly different, as the font size needed to be a little bit bigger the next time. So we made sure that the person working on the SAR that time, you know, this is when, you know, when you've done it all, because we just do it all as normal on the computer. When you do it all and you get to the printing out stage, these are the new requirements now, and we check every time they put a new SAR in, you know, are the old requirements the same? Do they need any further adjustments? And then we put it out.
No, no, for sure. Because it's the exact time we got to, are you really being fair if you're outputting it in a way that an individual can't engage with? And would that then be seen to be the individual putting in a SAR if you were going to output it in something that they can't do anything with? In that kind of sense, it's interesting that the ISO guidance has got some details on that in relation to ensuring that we've made reasonable adjustments where necessary, or at least where there's probably a bit more behind it. We might need to speak to the individual, as you kind of demonstrated there, but certainly an interesting point.
Absolutely. There's just one I wanted to pick up on here, because there's a question in the chat which is a very important one, and away from sort of the specifics necessarily of some of the more niche aspects that we've covered thus far. It's Jenny asking about whether anyone's been challenged by the ICO in relation to a DSAR response and how we protect ourselves. And I think I probably speak for us on this one, which primarily is audit trails, isn't it? Evidence, documenting everything, every part of the process, make sure that any decision made is thoroughly documented and you've got the records. And as far as I'm aware, because we, for those who may not know, we do handle subject access requests as an outsourced service for some of our clients, and we have been challenged on a number of occasions by the ICO on some of the decisions we've made. And every time it's just, here you go, here's the records of the decisions we made, here's why we made them, and that has worked at every single turn. So I think that's
the. I have seen it. Yeah, I mean, the getting the approach right is important. Absolutely, with you mentioned there, with the audit trails, accountability, demonstrating your thought process, being absolutely clear about the systems and the where you're looking for the information in that kind of sense. So I absolutely get all of that, and that will certainly help. But I've certainly seen challenges by individuals to the ICO, and the ICO asking questions around information that's not been supplied, and that kind of stuff. So I've asked for this information, you've just not sent this information, that kind of stuff, and challenges around those areas. I've certainly seen information wasn't supplied because the areas that they were looking in. Well, they had a bit of an organisation, a client at that time had a kind of a rather convoluted approach to who was processing and who were doing the relevant parts of information searches. But it transpired that the information the individual actually needed only existed within the emails. It's a report that the individual wanted. He was entitled to have it and address out and bits and pieces, but it rested in someone's email accounts, an employee's email account. Shall I just to add in there, the report was never actually attached to the CRM system, to the individual's case, and therefore it was easily missed, but it would highlight wider problems. So like I say, I get everything that Ollie said, but we do just need to make sure, are we looking everywhere? Are we making extensive searches? Have we covered everything as a base to substantiate the approach that we're taking?
For sure. For sure. Agreed. I think this sort of links into another point which I wanted to bring up, which is around, it sounds potentially almost daft and almost reductive, but actually genuinely properly understanding the concept of personal data. Again, I know that might sound ridiculous, but actually, as we know, the concept of personal data itself is pretty tricky to contend with, and on a case-by-case basis. You know, you look at things, is it actually their personal data just because there's an identifier of theirs in it? And we tend to see a lot of instances where that's not necessarily completely understood. I mean, you look at the email thing in particular, and what our very own Kathy Midgley would refer to as business as usual information. But you might get, as part of a SAR, a bunch of emails returned where the requester is copied into them, but fundamentally that email is not about them. It doesn't relate to them, therefore it's not their personal data. And I still see a lot of responses which don't take that sort of thing into account. Now, from a technical perspective, obviously you might not be able to take that into account because, you know, your systems might not be set up to make that distinction. But from, you know, a review perspective, being able to cut all that down is invaluable. And I don't know, maybe you two might disagree, but I still see a lot of instances where that particular concept isn't necessarily completely understood or applied.
I would agree. And it's some of it also comes down to individuals being able to actually interpret a document, because I've certainly seen stuff that may well constitute personal data, but certainly not personal data of the data subject. So you've got that element in there as well. One thing I was going to talk about personal data, and it's just to see what the feeling is. I'm not going to give my opinion on it initially, but if you look at the definition of personal data within Article 4 of the GDPR, and it says personal data means any information relating to an identified or identifiable natural person, and then it explains that identifiable natural person is one who can be identified directly or indirectly, in particular by reference to an identifier such as a name and an online identifier. So that's kind of all obvious stuff. We kind of understand that bit. But would anybody naturally then limit personal data or the definition of personal data to this next bit within the definition within the GDPR? And that is to one or more factors, psychological, genetic, mental, economic, cultural, or social identity of that natural person. So would you limit it to that, or would you go wider? Would you start looking at case law and bits and pieces? So you've got the differences with Durant and Edom and bits and pieces going in there. Would you naturally make the definition of personal data wider, or would you limit it saying, well, if it's not what it says in the definition in 4.1, then it's not personal data under the GDPR. And if it's not under the GDPR, then it's not caught by the SARS, which is governed by the same GDPR.
That's a very good question. I think, and if I've understood your question correctly, I think the crux of it really is that ultimately, from a systems perspective, we're only really able to run searches for identifiers. And therefore, you are limited to that initial chunk of your definition there, because fundamentally, you can't. It's incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to run searches for personal data expanded to that extent.
Yeah, this is kind of coming back to trying to understand the term personal data. And in essence, where we've got this term business as usual. So you may have, say you put a subject access request, Ollie, and it's got decisions that you've made as an individual but about business, not about yourself, not about somebody else, but about business. So you might be commenting on finance, you might be commenting on structure of the organisation or something. Now, you could say, well, that's got your name on it, so it's personal data. It identifies you as an employee of DPP, so therefore it's personal data. In that sense, it's your opinion, so it's your opinion relates to you, and therefore it's your personal data in that sense. But if you go by that last kind of sentence within within paragraph 4.1, if your opinion about, let's say, a particular service development that DPP are looking at in that sense, if that doesn't fall into the physical, psychological, genetic, mental, economic, cultural or social identity of you, does that then make, does that make a bigger case for business as usual in that sense, saying, well, actually, your opinion of something of a work matter isn't caught by that definition, and therefore it's not personal data for the purposes of the GDPR?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure I've got an answer to it, but I tell you just to build on that, I have got a use case, an example that might be interesting to ponder in that context, which is that I had a case recently, a client was asking me about whereby they had an individual who unfortunately was made redundant, and the reason behind that was that their position, in fact, was made redundant within the organisation. Their job role what's the word I'm looking for? I've completely lost my train of thought. They basically got rid of the job role rather than the individual. And as part of that redundancy, the individual put in a SAR and said, well, I want all the information relating to the decision making around my job role. And initially they'd compiled a lot of it. And when I spoke to them, I said, well, hang on a second, because all these conversations you're having about this job role, do they relate to that individual or do they relate to that job role, to that position? Because if all of your conversations are about, you know, whether there is scope within the organisation for, let's say, a DPO for the sake of argument, and not whether the specific person holding the role of DPO is currently, you know, doing enough to justify their position, that's a very different can of worms, I'd have thought. That's a very different conversation to be having, and it might well be that a lot of that information which relates to conversations around the job role aren't that individual's personal data, because it's not about them, it's about the role in question. What do you reckon, Gary? You've been very quiet for the last 5 minutes. I've fielded a couple of Dave's curveballs, so I think you can field one of mine.
I agree. I think it's obvious that person probably wanted clarity on why their role was made redundant. And I think, you know, they can ask for that. And I think maybe the company should consider giving, you know, a wider answer. So they could have all the stuff that's directly related to them being made redundant. But I think if they're just talking more generally about the role, they maybe wouldn't give that because it's not directly about the person, but they could provide sort of a summary or some sort of context to explain to the person, if they haven't done already, you know, why they don't need that particular role, but that it's not them as a person.
Yeah.
If I can just jump in there as well, let's not forget, we need to kind of consider if a SAR goes in during the process of the redundancy being decided, then you wouldn't get it under the management forecasting if it's going to be prejudicial to that activity. So it's not necessarily that they would get it at that point. You could argue that they may get the decisions on redundancy and that bit what you just explained, Carrie, after the fact that it's the release of that information is not going to be prejudicial to anything. But if it's going to be prejudicial to determining the outcome of decisions, then it certainly wouldn't be released up front.
Yeah, for sure. And there's that, and there's also potentially the negotiations exemption, which Lucinda mentions. There's something actually that I wanted to come back on, Emma's sort of supporting what we're saying with some ICO guidance, and actually there's some very good CNIL guidance we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about emails in the context of SARs. But one of the things that Emma sort of touches on there is that we've got to remember that the right is a right to access data. It's not a right to access documents. So ultimately, if that person is copied into, you know, let's say a regular email goes out every week, a status report or something, KPIs, and they're copied into that every week, there is absolutely no need to give them every single one of those emails. You just tell them they were copied into that email every week for however long. you know, just because it's got their email address in it and that is an identifier doesn't necessarily mean that particular information associated with it is personal data, I'd have thought. So this is the main reason I brought it up, because
I think it's really valid, because it still comes back to the definition of personal data. So it's personal data means information relating to an identified or identifiable person. So a name, you could argue, relates to an individual, unless it's such a generic name that it doesn't really identify anybody particularly, but doesn't necessarily mean that the information you're copied into relates to you. So yes, your name might, but doesn't necessarily mean the information of itself does.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what I was getting at. That's far better put than I was putting it across. Right. Well, we're almost out of time already, but we've probably still got a couple of minutes considering we started a bit later this week. So, Carrie, I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to cover from a top tips or recommendations perspective.
I think just something that could be dead quick that we can cover quickly is when putting together your SAR, considering your chronology of it. It's quite difficult when you're doing a SAR and you're starting with the most recent day stuff, especially if it goes on for a few years and you're sort of finding out, oh, who is this person? Who is this person? How do they relate to this person? And then you suddenly go like 200 pages and 5 years back and you figure it all out. And you've already started redacting bits of it. It's much better to try and work your chronology so that the earliest stuff is what you're looking at first. So you're building that story of that person. So you know how these different third parties may or may not have come in and out of that person's life. And also what they already know. Because sometimes with SARs relating to children, it can talk about their parents having different like mental health issues and things like that. And it's difficult to know how much the child is already aware of that. But then the further you go earlier into the SAR, you can see actually the child is aware of this already about their parent. And then you can sort of reconsider how you're going to redact it. But I think it's just sort of making sure you go from oldest to newest makes redacting SARs a lot easier. Yeah, I don't know if anybody else has that opinion point. Or if that's just the way that I like to do them.
Yeah, no, I think that's an entirely fair point. Jenny asks whether we are allowed to ask what they want to gain from the SAR, which is an interesting one. We talked a little bit about this on the previous session, which is, you know, ultimately the right of access is supposed to be considered to be purpose blind, right? It's not meant to have, we shouldn't consider what people want or why they're putting them in. It's just a right that they can use. But actually in practice, we know full well that that's not the case. And you know, even case law backs up that, you know, people putting in SARs for various reasons can impact on whether it's manifestly unfounded or excessive. And I think we'd all be in agreement that trying to as part of your scoping exercise, you know, inquire with individuals as to what they want and why is not just allowed, but I personally recommend it, I'd have said, because then you actually know what you're looking for, you know what to provide it, and you're going to minimise the risk of the person being disappointed, aren't you?
I would actually support that on the grounds of the fact that if you ask enough questions and scope it properly, you find out actually the information that they're after wouldn't necessarily be accessed under a SAR, then you can deal with it appropriately at that point. Personally.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all to do with your scoping, isn't it? Which is one of the number one things that we promote and we spoke about a lot last week, which is, you know, you get your scope right to begin with, well, you're off to a winner, aren't you? Because then ultimately you've you know, if you scope it properly, then your search is minimized, you can find the documents more easily, you can return them more easily, you know what to redact and what not to redact with far greater ease. So just generally it's a simplified exercise if you get the scoping right, I think. So on that note, I tell you what, we're probably out of time, so I'll come to you both if that's all right for one last parting thought or recommendation. As I did last week, we haven't really spoken about it much, but I'm going to put it out as my recommendation again as a final thought, which is retention. I said this last time and I'm going to stick with that, which is one of the number one things you can do to help yourself and your organization from a SAR management perspective is have good retention criteria and processes in place, because it's not accessible if you don't hold it in the first place, basically. Dave, what's what's your final thought?
Yeah, a couple of bits. And I don't know if you covered them in the in part one, or whether it means we're going to have part three to SARS. But it's is for me, it's particularly around understanding exemptions and how they work, because I often see individuals or organisations trying to use exemptions without necessarily fully understanding the fact that some of them may have to have can only be applied to the extent that they're going to be prejudicial to something. I've certainly seen, especially around legal advice and litigation advice, things being claimed as legal advice when the document's not really got advice in it, nor put together for the predominant purpose of litigation in that sense. You may still be able to possibly withhold it if you've got client confidentiality and bits and pieces going on under common law of confidence, but just make sure we understand the exemptions and understand how they work. Because it sometimes feels like people kind of go through the exemptions, read the title of the exemption and go, oh, management forecasting, I can use that one, without necessarily thinking, well, is the actual bit that I want to exempt prejudicial or not prejudicial? So it comes back to being case by case, but really understand the application of the exemptions, because they can be a bit tricky.
Yes, agreed. Absolutely. They can very much be tricky. Carrie, any parting thoughts for us?
I think I mentioned this one last time as well, was coming back to scoping. So not only so that you can get the information correct, you know, speak to the data subjects if their request is actually kind of garbled and makes no sense at all, so you can figure out what they're wanting to get the information, but also making sure that the person who's going to be checking through all this information is well aware of what's in it, and if it's upsetting any material in there, that they're aware of that too, so it's not a surprise.
Yeah, agreed. There's a request in the chat for a session on exemptions themselves, which I'm certainly not opposed to, although we'd probably have to spend more time preparing it than I did this, which I did in about 10 minutes this morning, in all honesty. We'd actually have to put a fair bit of thought into that. But if people want a session on exemptions, whether it's to SARS or more generally the exemptions, then
I would. Just to qualify that one, because there's quite a few. If you do want a session on exemptions, could you kind of forward in the ones you'd like us to kind of cover off? Because in the time we have for this, we might not be able to cover all of them.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean,
I can help you plan it with like the ones I've seen most commonly used. Like, I've not used every single exemption. There's ones like it just always seems to be the same couple of exemptions that I've ever used in sort of council scenarios and stuff. And I could go on for days about stupid redactions that I've seen.
I'm sure we all could.
That's a whole different thing.
It is. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll definitely put some thought into that. If it's something that people want to see, then we can work on that. As Dave says, if there's any in particular that you want to see, then do forward them in, because if not, I think we'll probably just work off of the basis so that we'll work through the ones we work with most regularly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we can talk about paragraph 16, rights and freedoms of others, etc. But until then, we'll be back next week with an episode, I'm going to say, of GDPR Radio, but I don't know that for certain, Miles, if you want to correct me. But I believe it should be one of our open surgery sessions.
It is GDPR Radio next week. We're actually shaping up a lineup of topics for the coming months. So if anybody who is a subscriber has any suggestions, anything that they'd like to hear in the future in March and April, then do get in touch and let us know what you'd like to hear from us, and we can put together some new topics of conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Please do get in touch with anything you want to hear, anything you want to see, anything that might be of interest. So in the meantime, as I say, we're back next week. You can find a link to the recording from this session if ever you want to check back over it or share it around. Wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Music, Spotify, and also on the DPP website, they're all available up there now. That'll be uploaded over the course of this afternoon as soon as Mars has edited it. And on that note, I will wish you all a very lovely weekend. Thank you very much, Dave and Carrie, for your time and your help. Thank you, everyone, for attending. And we'll see you all next week.
No worries. Thank you very much. Take care, everybody.